Hello, and welcome once again to Science Chat. My name is Sean Marshall. I know it's been a while since the last episode, and hopefully there's still some of you out there listening. Earlier this week, I met up with Brian Trench on a fantastic late summer's evening in the sunny southeast of Ireland to talk about libel in science journalism. Brian is a science communication practitioner of many years and was until recently the chair of the master's degree in science communication in DCU. Brian has also worked as a journalist and contributor to RT Radio and other broadcasters. Brian, a lot has been said and written about libel in science journalism in the last year since the preliminary hearing into the libel case that the British Chiropractic Association had taken against Simon Singh. This case has now been resolved, of course, with the BCA withdrawing their claim for libel in April of this year. How difficult is it for a journalist to make a comment like the comment that Singh made without finding themselves sued for libel as a result?
I've been following science journalism as a practitioner, first of all, and then as a teacher and researcher latterly for 30 years. And I would say that libel cases were rare to non-existent in science journalism, certainly as compared with other branches of journalism like political journalism, business journalism, current affairs journalism generally, maybe even sports journalism and arts journalism. I would say it was, you know, I actually honestly cannot recall a case over 30 years up to the Singh case. Now, the Singh case made me more alert, if you like many other people, to the phenomenon of libel actions in communication about science and talking and writing about science generally. And so now I'm a bit more aware of other kinds of cases that have to do less with journalism, actually, than to do with exchanges between scientists. So the Simon Singh case, I think, is very interesting. It's very dramatic. But it's pretty distinctive and not typical of the general run of things at all. In fact, if you take the point a little bit further, I would say it kind of reflects how much science journalism is itself kind of celebratory or just generally supportive of science, how rare to non-existent libel actions actually are. You know, what prompts libel actions is criticism, and criticism that's gone beyond the bounds because it's then become personal and abusive, or is deemed to be personal and abusive. The fact that you have so few libel actions in this domain suggests that actually science journalism is rather not as critical as it, or sceptical or as forthright as it sometimes should be.
So you don't think it's anything to do with the fact that science journalism, if they do criticise, they're actually putting more of a constructive case against somebody, whereas in the other fields that you mentioned, if somebody is libelling, it's more clear-cut. I mean, science is where somebody makes a claim and there's a counterclaim made by somebody else who disagrees with them, whereas in the standard type of libel case, it's where, you know, somebody takes somebody's name and they say something specific about them.
Yes, fair enough, but you know, we know there's misconduct in science. The misconduct in science has very, very rarely been exposed by journalists writing about science. It's more typically been exposed by colleagues, you know, being uncomfortable with the practices that others were following and this kind of thing. So when you're talking about misconduct, you're talking about somebody on a personal basis acting in a dishonest way. So were you to say such a thing in print without proof and without, you know, sufficient support, you know, you would be opening yourself up to a potential libel action. So I take the point that you're making, that most debate in science, including debate that might be strong disagreement, is presented not in personal terms, but in terms of the substance of the argument. But, you know, in a highly politicized area of science like climate science, people call each other, you know, very, you know, abusive things, you know, call each other by strong names. And you would expect that if journalists were engaged in that area too, that they would get drawn into those kinds of debates and might be exposed to libel actions, but actually I'm not aware that there have been even in that highly charged space of climate science, I'm not aware that there have been many cases of libel or threatened libel actions.
So the libel case in this particular instance, the claim that was made by Simon Singh was that he was basically disagreeing with the evidence that the British Chiropractic Association was prepared to stand over.
Yeah.
And in that case, there needs to be some element where science journalists, if science journalists are to do their job properly, are able to do this.
Yeah.
And because of that, do you think that there's any cause for saying that there should be a special case for science journalism within the libel laws?
No, I mean, I think that the case that galvanized our attention is an interesting one from several dimensions, where Singh and, like him, Ben Goldacre in another space, have actually taken on the authority not just of writers and journalists, but actually of quasi or proxy scientists, marshalling their own, and Simon Singh has scientific qualifications, though he no longer practices as a scientist, and Ben Goldacre is a doctor. So they're saying, from my appreciation or my understanding or my assessment of what is scientific evidence and how it's produced and how it is assessed and how it is validated, etc., etc., the claims made by the British Chiropractic Association are not valid. Or the claims made by nutritionist X or nutritionist Y in the Ben Goldacre case are not valid. In other words, they're actually exercising a different kind of authority from the one that typically a journalist exercises. They're more or less acting as scientists.
Okay, so what you're saying is these people who are purporting to be science journalists are actually behaving like a scientist making the counterclaim rather than being
a journalist. More typically would actually go to another authority and say, quote them,
right,
saying, no, this is not true, yeah, no, this is not valid, no, this person doesn't have a basis for making this claim, or whatever. That would be the more usual journalistic method. But back to your previous question, is there a special case in science? I'm not convinced. I have bitter experience with libel laws in Ireland, which are very similar to the libel laws in Britain, which have been the focus of the Singh case, and one or two other cases. I think the libel laws have been very restrictive, as we know them in Ireland and Britain, very restrictive, excessively so, and I think it made no sense to run a campaign as it was run around the Simon Singh case, at least for a time, keep the libel laws out of science. I'm making that point as a strong critic of the libel laws. I don't see why science as a social space, as a public space, should not also have some laws that allow a person to defend their reputation where they feel they've been seriously wronged.
Okay.
But the implication of saying keep libel laws out of science was saying, no, everybody should be allowed to say anything about anybody on good scientific authority. Yeah, well, maybe not. Maybe on the best of scientific authority, on the best of scientific judgment, you make a wrong assessment. And you make a wrong assessment of a person that actually then damages their reputation. And if that is the case, and it may even have been done without malice, but if that is the case, then, somebody should have redress. So I don't see that there is a special case for science. I think there are interesting cases that arise in science to do with libel and to do with freedom of expression that are specific to science, but don't see that the legal situation should be different, that you, as it were, cordon off science and say the libel laws don't apply here.
Okay, well, the preliminary hearing into the Simon Singh case, the judgment hinged as to whether or not what he had said was fair comment.
Yes.
And
that's a general criterion of libel law, libel cases in general, beyond the specific case.
And that comes down then to the judgment of one single High Court judge. So how fair is that if you're going, as a science communication practitioner yourself, how fair is it that that can be, you know, that can happen, that it can be down to one individual.
It's not fair, but it's easier for us to say that now that the British Chiropractic Association has withdrawn their case, so they've acknowledged that they didn't have enough substance in the case to pursue it. But it's not fair, whether it's about politics or business or about the arts as well. So I just don't see it that there's a special case here. Okay, I'll tell you, I recall many cases, for instance, to do with Goodman and the beef industry, you know, where Goodman's lawyers were threatening all sorts of libel actions against people who were reporting investigations of malpractice in some of the group's beef plants. And I specifically remember about the early 1990s that RTE's Farm News, or whatever it was called at the time, reported on an investigation connected with a Goodman-owned plant in County Limerick. And Arthur Cox, one of the biggest legal firms, sent around a letter threatening action against RTE and any other media that reported this investigation. Yeah. And on the one and only case that I, as a reviewer of the newspapers in the morning programme on RTE, was asked by an editor either to do something specifically or not to do something specifically, the one single case that I was ever asked was, don't mention the Goodman investigation. Yeah. Now, we know as a result of the Beef Tribunal that there was bad stuff going on. But for years, I mean, much longer than the 2 years in the British Chiropractic Association case, for years, people couldn't touch the Goodman story because of these threats of libel actions that were used. Yeah. And there's myriad other examples in the property field and in the business field and in the political field and so on, where this chill that's been referred to was applied, and people did not write stories that they knew or believed there was good evidence for, because there was a threat that had been issued, you know, that libel action would be instigated and so on. So, you know, it's not fair, but that's a comment on the state of the libel laws in general, which have been somewhat improved in Ireland as a result of recent reform, where the fair comment defence is now possible, where an apology is not an admission of guilt, but actually can be taken into account when the case is taken further as an act of good faith to try and remedy the situation where a mistake may have been made and so on. So there have been some improvements there, but I mean, the general point still applies that the libel laws have applied right across the board and have been used by people in very frequently in powerful positions with deep pockets and able to employ, you know, big lawyers to shut people up. And that's, maybe a lot of that isn't known because, of course, those stories couldn't be published.
And outside of the stories that, like that have been affected by this libel chill, do you think that there is much, or that there are many stories out there that haven't even got to that stage, you know, that people have sat down and have been thinking about writing a story or have started to write a story, and before there's even been a need for someone to threaten them with libel, they've looked at what they've written and just said, oh well,
it's not worth going for.
It's not worth, yeah.
I'm not aware of it in the case of reporting of science or communicating about science generally. However, it was mentioned certainly in that discussion in the Science Gallery, where Simon Singh was present, and his case was very well articulated by himself and his lawyer, and the case of Peter Wilmshurst and the action taken against him by an American pharmaceutical company and his lawyer were also there. It was mentioned, it was claimed, without specific cases being mentioned, because maybe you can't even mention specific cases in this kind of context. You know, I know of a story that Sean Marshall would have written if he had been not being restrained by fear of the libel laws and so on. It's very hard to make those cases public in specific terms. It was mentioned there that there were such cases. I've never heard of them. I've never had any colleague in the Irish science journalism field come to me and say, I'd love to write this story, but I know I'd be in deep trouble there, you know, from the libel laws or threat of libel action or whatever if I did it. And going back to my earlier point, I kind of wish that people were pushing the boat out of that, that bit further, where they would actually have to deal with that as an issue, you know, where, you know, there's discussion going on in the science communication community at the moment about, you know, words that make you cringe, like breakthroughs and first ever and leading edge and cutting edge and all this sort of stuff. You know, well, actually, how many people would have written a story or even thought about writing a story that actually, you know, punctured some of these claims? Because these claims are being made by PR companies or by public information officers of universities and research centres and so on. Actually, most stories that appear actually simply, okay, they might strip out the hyperbole, but they don't actually examine the hyperbole and say, look, here's a string of claims that have been made by this research centre, by these researchers, by this institution, so on. Inflated claims. You know, actually, they're not the first. Here's the evidence that they're not the first. Here, it's not a breakthrough. It's not a breakthrough for these reasons. It's not actually leading edge because there are people who have gone much further in this case, in this case, in this case. Actually, putting things into a bigger context and maybe running the risk that actually they lose those people as a source. But that's not happening. That kind of science journalism is not actually being done either here or most other places. Maybe it should be.
That's kind of going back to what you said at the outset, that, you know, that science journalism just seems to be reaffirming what they're being told. So in all, it's almost like the science journalists that are writing in the newspapers at the moment are very much, they're almost like part of the same PR machine for the actual research.
Well, okay, if I were actually to confirm that that's the case, I'm now running the risk of libeling my colleagues. And I'm not actually saying that. I'm saying that there are, you know, that there is a generally approving tone to most science stories. And this is contrary to what most scientists think, because the one they remember the cases that were either, you know, sensationalist or dramatic or misreported or inaccurate or whatever. Most science stories in most media that we have access to here in this part of the world are, she said this, he said that. Very, very few of them are saying, and you know what? They're wrong. And here's why they're wrong. There's very little of that kind of reporting done. It's done in other areas. It's not done in the science area. So this is by way of just again saying, you know, perhaps the interest in the libel laws is slightly distracting us from a much bigger concern, that, or something that should be a much bigger concern, which is that there is very little investigation, criticism, critique, skeptical kind of journalism going on in this area, or communication in general. I'm not just journalists. They're under incredible pressure to just produce story after story after story. They don't frequently have the time to dig back, even when they remember, no, this isn't a first. I remember this coming up before.
What about blogs and other internet forums then? I mean, clearly they can't be considered to be outside the law in terms of libel. But, I mean, I produce a very modest blog on science communication myself. And since hearing about the Simon Singh case, and particularly since listening to him talk at the Science Gallery, I mean, it's come home to me that something that I write on my blog, which is hosted by an Irish company, if someone in the UK was to read that and feel that they were libeled, do you think maybe that there's a need for a special case for the internet, for blogs, where the media forum is, it's so different from the traditional media forum?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting issue, because there's not an awful lot of case law here in relation to libel in internet fora. I mean, there are some big cases, but not enough, as it were, to say where exactly do we stand. You know, given that a blog can be read in 200 different jurisdictions around the world, could in principle somebody who really wanted to be just, you know, vexatious and tie up your blog in knots, such that you'd have to close down, could they take an action in each of 200 jurisdictions? In principle, they could. In principle, they could. Now, obviously, not 200 jurisdictions in the world don't have libel laws that are would allow this to happen easily, but there might be a few dozen.
Which would be enough, I think.
Which would be enough to put the wind up you. Okay. And we tend to say things in much less formal terms in blogs, and that's part of their charm,
yeah,
part of their attraction, and part of why you and other people do them. Than you might do in newspapers. And there are also less checks and balances. I mean, everything that's written in newspapers, being through, you know, has been in front of four or five pairs of eyes before it gets to the reader's eyes. Everything that's been on radio has been, you know, in front of one hopes. And there are, of course, well-known cases of live radio where this hasn't happened. There's a case going on at the moment, as we know. You know, Mary Harney is doing News Talk. You know, but in principle, there's a producer, or there's a researcher, and there's you know, there are other people listening. And blogs tend to be the work of one person who simply writes directly from their keyboard to the world. So the risks there for bloggers who want to take on somebody or some interest or some authority or some institution, the risks there are massive because there aren't those checks and balances. On the other hand, they may be so obscure and so actually little visible in the public domain that nobody would be bothered with them. So, you know, there may be a big risk in one way, in one way, and a little risk in another case, because you only sue somebody, you only prosecute an action to the end for libel if you think you're actually going to get some money off somebody.
Yeah.
You know, get some redress. Okay, the satisfaction of closing down your blog would be pretty small. You know.
Thanks.
Getting you to publish an apology, paying for a half page of the Irish Times or the Irish Independent to publish an apology, that's a bit different, but you don't have the resources to do that.
Exactly.
And so people would make a judgment, and lawyers make a judgment, that okay, it's not worth pursuing this case. Shot across the bows, tell them to stop doing it, that might be enough. So I would hesitate to predict, but be not too surprised if there isn't some big case to do with a blog. And maybe there have been some big cases in the States in the political area and so on that I'm just not aware. Although the libel laws in the States make it less easy than in this part of the world, Britain and Ireland, to pursue an individual author or publisher or whatever. This is virgin territory or uncharted territory, but it's certainly new, and I think that there's some interesting case going to happen sometime sooner rather than later, which will set
the precedents.
Well, there'll be precedents in this jurisdiction, because the precedents are only precedents for particular jurisdictions, because the laws are different in one place from another case. But we don't have enough precedents to say what the risks are here, but if I was blogging in this area of, you know, science policy, science funding, and so on, I'd be aware, certainly, that there were risks here that I would need to consider, and I would bring my journalism experience, my journalism training, to bear on that. But a lot of people don't have that journalism training or journalism experience who are blogging and who might actually almost unwittingly blunder into something, you know, that, you know, repeat an abusive term about somebody who's easy to abuse, like Gillian McKeith, not doctor, and so on, and just say it enough times for her or lawyers to say, okay, that's enough. We will send you a proof of her PhD from the College of X in the United States, America, and now we'll say to you, you stop saying not doctor, and the next time we do, you know, you'll pay the consequences, you know.
Yeah. You mentioned Gillian McKeith, of course. That's a very recent and very interesting example of what can happen with these media forums and with social networking and stuff. I mean, I think it was Ben Goldacre, actually, you know, kind of like poacher turned gamekeeper, who almost was able to say that if Gillian McKeith didn't take things down from her Twitter account, which she later claimed not to be her Twitter account, I believe, that he could have actually sued her for libel for the things that she was saying.
Yeah.
I think that's very interesting to see that happen.
I think that on one of her tweets, or the tweets in her name, and I think the issue is there that she obviously doesn't do everything solo. She has people work for her.
Yeah.
No more than sports stars write their own websites and so on. So I think that's where the kind of fudge question came from, that she may not personally have written the tweets in her name. But she said of Goldacre was it that he was a liar or something like that? Yeah, okay. And, you know, if you accuse somebody of a liar, then you open yourself up to a slander action if it's said in speech, and a libel action if it's said in writing. A defamation action, one way or the other. I think Bendigo Laker ought to, you know, have known not then to get onto his high horse and start saying, I could sue her, you know, well, not going to. Like, he has taken her on big time over quite some years now as an example of what he thinks is pseudo scientific nutritional advice.
Yeah.
You know, you are what you eat and so on. And she's a pretty big one to take on too, because she has TV programs and she has books galore and she has all sorts of endorsements, etc., etc. But he knows damn well what he's doing, and he must know the risks that he's running, because he's taken her on as a person. As a personality, it's not even like the British Chiropractic Society or British Chiropractic Association.
Yeah.
You know. So, if she then turns around and decides to sue him, he must have factored that into his thinking about this. You know, because it's not just simply saying, you know, this nutritional science is not valid science for the following scientific reasons. It's this person, Gillian McKeith, is a fraud. And I don't know if he's actually used exactly those words, but that's what it amounts to. That amounts to what his case amounts to. Well, he has to live with the consequences of, you know, of that if she decides to sue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on that note, I'd like to say thanks very much, Brian, for talking to me on this wonderful summer evening, for all the listeners of Science Chat. Thank you.
Yeah, they don't know how to run the summer's evening.
They do now.
Thanks very much, John.
Thanks. Well, that's it for this episode. As usual, you can find me on my blog on www.sciencechat.net/wordpress, where you can comment on this and other episodes.